I want to start out by asking you a question. Where are you headed? Israel came out of Egypt with a high hand. It was God's intention to carry them into the promised land in the first year. But you know the story. They got distracted after the spies went into the land somewhere about Pentecost in that second year, and they got discouraged. They didn't obey God. And I remember as a youngster, there was a song that was sung in the churches sometime, "Oh, who will go with me to the promised land?" That was one of the refrains in it. So where are we headed? Are we headed to the promised land? I mean, humanity is in the world as a whole or as a nation, or we as a church. But more to the point, that's a big subject. We need to say, where are you headed, or where am I headed? So I'd like to focus more on the individual rather than the broad message to the world as a whole. Of course, we're in this world and are affected by it. Jesus addressed that in his prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. So we need to realize that from the very start. You know, we are in the world. We can't be taken out of it. In verse 14 of chapter 17, this is Christ praying to the Father there the night before he was crucified. I'm in the wrong chapter, wrong book. John 17. I think that's what I said, but I didn't turn there. John 17 and verse 14. Jesus prayed, "I have given them your word," and the world has hated them because they are not of this world, even as I am not of this world. I pray not that you should take them out of the world. We're in the world. We can't do anything about that. But you should keep them from the evil or the evil one. They are not in the world, even as I am not in the world. They're not part of this world. We're here physically, but we're not spiritually. We're not part of it. Now, a few weeks ago, our daughter came to see us and spent 4 or 5 days with us. She brought a series of videos, movies, if you will. They had a very good message of love, good character, and history. They were all G and PG rated. It was based on a series of novels by Janet Oak, or O-K-E, I guess it's Oak, maybe Oakie. She primarily intended them for she and her mother to view, and I remember thinking, oh, am I going to have to look at these too? You know, put on the main TV, that means I couldn't watch the ball game or from my favorite chair. So I said, well, I can bear that, I guess. So I think they watched the first one. Then I decided to be sociable and join them on the next evening and watch one too. They were a series about a pioneer family that migrated from western Missouri about 150 years ago, went out there and homesteaded a place, and then eventually some of them went on, I guess, into Kansas, went further west. So I started out on that first one I watched sort of picking it apart, at least in turn. I don't think I said too much, but I noticed that some of the unrealistic conditions, you know, it was a good movie, but it was sort of a grade B for the scenery and all, because they had a 3-year drought, and yet all their cattle were fat. I couldn't figure that out. They had no water, and they were hauling water, but they all were dressed in real frilly clothes out in a cabin. You know, showed the cabin, it was rough. When they came there, it was an old cabin that they refurbished, had a big old hole in the roof, and just in a few weeks, they came there, they had no money. Everything they owned was in a wagon. They came there, they had it all fixed up, they had all these frilly clothes on, and just living, you know, like kings, you might say, if it, some of the scenes, but yet they had it very hard. So they even showed one scene where a woman was out plowing in a hoop skirt. But, you know, getting away from that, about halfway through the movie, I began to focus on the message. And it was a very good story. It might have been low budget on the set, but it had some realistic messages, a very good message. I watched it, and I ended up watching four or five more, and I'm really glad I did, because it emphasized what's important in life. Not the hurry-hurry lifestyle we have today, not the material things that we're so much worried about. Turn over to 1 John 2, 15. For all that's in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. So that was very evident there that they weren't focused on the fine things in life because they didn't have them. Everything they owned originally was in a wagon that they came out there, and they lived under harsh conditions. And they built this country with God's blessings, you know, not these actors, but people like them. And I'm sure this was simplified and it showed it in a very good respect. These were real civilized people, but there's some very bad things that happened to them. In the first movie, the man and the woman and a small girl arrived with really nothing. They almost lost their homestead due to this 3 or 4 year drought. And it's shortly after that, the mother died of scarlet fever, leaving the man with a 8-year-old daughter. Then we came to number two, and a new couple arrived over the homestead next door. He fell off a horse, hit his head on a rock, and killed him just in the first few weeks he was there. And the lady went into shock, as you might can imagine. She was a young lady there by herself. And they were getting ready to have a funeral, and she was just in shock. So neighbor lady came in and told her she'd better get her act together because they was fixing to bury her husband if she wanted to go to the funeral. So she began to straighten up and kind of get ready. And just as she was about to get ready to go, this first man came in, came where she was, and this sounds bad at first, but said, "Ma'am, I have an 8-year-old daughter. It needs a mama. If you stay with us and it doesn't work out, I will pay your way back on the stage next spring." And so she was just went almost into further shock. But after thinking about it a little, she agreed to stay with them. So she and the girl had one room and the man another. And that's the way it more or less ended in that movie. Except the little girl wouldn't have anything to do with the woman. I don't want to bore you with all this, but just to show how harsh it was, those settlers back in those days. And the number three, the 8-year-old girl wouldn't accept her mother. The lady did not accept the man, whose name was Clark, until it was about time for her to leave. Then she finally realized that she cared for him, and she decided to stay. And at number four, it would focus more on the 8-year-old girl who learned to love and care for her stepmother very much. She married a boy, and they took off in a wagon further west to start a ranch, I think maybe out in Kansas somewhere. So they too had a great deal of adversity. And from time to time they prayed. It wasn't long prayers. It was like two sentences. "Lord, we thank you for what we have. We pray you be with us," or something like that. It sounded very sincere. It was all very politically correct. There was no Indian raids. They didn't kill any Indians. A few Indians they had were friendly. They didn't have any robbers, except one episode had a few robbers, and there wasn't any shooting or anything. I think one of the robbers shot one of the other robbers, but other than that, there was no deaths, and they treated them very humanely. So I'm not sure that was totally realistic how it was out on the frontier. But it made me realize, you know, how good we have it today. Or do we have it good today? Who has the better life? Things have changed very much in the last 150 years. But, you know, God has not changed. Malachi 3 and verse 6, we can turn over there. You might could quote it, but we'll just read it. Malachi 3, 6. Says, "For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed." So God hasn't changed. Mankind has changed. and back over in the New Testament to Hebrews, the 13th chapter. Hebrews 13 and verse 8. It says, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. So we see the Father and Jesus Christ neither have changed. They're the same. Their purpose is to change. And I would imagine if we went back 300 years, which would be 150 years before these people were there, there would be a lot of differences in the way people live 300 years ago than even 150 years ago. Probably more between 150 than now, but certainly there would be some changes. And if we went back even further into medieval Europe during the Spanish Inquisition, there was religious persecution and some pretty bad things, some famines, black death, all sorts of things. And if we go on back into Rome and Greece, all the way back even to the Tower of Babel and to the flood, and even back to creation, there's been change all down through human history. Man has changed greatly over time. But over this whole period, God's purpose has not changed. He had a plan at the very start, and he hasn't deviated from it. We haven't always understood it, but his plan has been constant. He had always planned to bring many sons to glory, sons and daughters. Of course, his plan has phases. It wasn't his plan right out to go to save the world all at once. He's in no hurry. In his wisdom and mercy, everyone will eventually have a chance. Certainly, he's not going to send people to hell like many of us learned or thought we knew when we were growing up, when the hellfire and brimstone preacher said, you know, you accept Jesus today or you're going to die and go to hell. Well, that's not the way it is. We're thankful that we know that. You know, I always wondered why you'd hear the preacher say that on his sermons, then somebody would die, and he'd get up and talk. You know, it didn't matter how crusty old fellow he was up there with Jesus. You know, it didn't really make sense. So I'm glad we understand those things. Now, these movies I was talking about, the main character, the father, eventually the grandfather, his name was Clark. And soon after one of his daughters had lost a child, well, his only daughter had lost a child on something similar to, she already had one child, and she had another one that was young and healthy and put her to sleep at night, woke up, she was dead. I guess it was something like sudden death syndrome. Well, she too went into shock. And they survived that, and they were coming out, and things were looking up, and he said four simple words. He said, God has perfect timing. They understood God's plan to extent. But they really didn't understand it, but they trusted in God. And I've thought about that. That was a truism. Well, I'm sure they didn't understand exactly what it meant, but God does have perfect timing. Whatever he does is for a purpose. When someone dies or suffers, it's not just like it's all over. It's going to seem, in retrospect, pretty minor when they're resurrected. We believe that in the end, most people will accept salvation when they finally understand the truth. But it could be less than we think, because some folks are so hardened. You know, I've wondered about some of these terrorists we have. It's going to be hard for them. They've, from the time they were born, they were taught that the Jews in particular were like pigs. You know, they weren't even human. And they hate them. Even in their first grade, second grade, they're taught that. So it's going to be hard when they're resurrected, and even in after the millennium and things are normal and wonderful, and when they're given a chance, it's going to be hard, I think, for them to accept it. Hopefully they will. Maybe that's why God's going to give them 100 years. But it involves a process where God, I believe, is checking us out. Everyone will be checked out. Primarily individually. And I'm talking about those that God is calling. Turn over to 1 Peter, and that's you and me, brethren. 1 Peter 4. And verse 18. Peter 4 and verse 18 says, if the righteous scarcely be saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? So even the righteous will scarcely be saved. And of course, that's with God's great love and mercy and compassion for us. So we need to keep that in mind. 1 Corinthians 9, if you'll turn back there. 1 Corinthians 9, we'll begin at verse 22 through 27. 1 Corinthians 9, 22. Do the weak become I as weak, that I might gain the weak? I made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some, or bring the truth to some and get their attention and convict them. And this I do for the gospel's sake, that I might be partakers therefore with you. Know you not that they which run a race run all, but one receiveth the prize? So run that you may obtain. And every man that striveth for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, not as uncertainly. I fight not as one that beateth the air, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So even Paul realized that he could fall away. It's not a done deal. We don't, just because we're called and we're converted, we don't have it made. Turn over to Philippians, the third chapter. We don't have to get overly concerned about this because he's promised to never forsake us and leave us. But Philippians 3 and verse 10, Paul says, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering, being made conformable unto his death. If by any means I might obtain unto the resurrection of the dead, not as though I have already attained, Paul didn't have it made, neither were already perfect, but I follow after, if that I may apprehend that for which I am apprehended of Jesus, of Christ Jesus. Brethren, I count not myself to have apprehended or already attained, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth unto those things which are before. I press towards the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Jesus Christ. So that's the way Paul viewed it, and that's the way we ought to view it. If you turn back over to 1 Peter, the fifth chapter again, 1 Peter 1 and verse 1 Peter 5 and verse 6. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting off all care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walking about, seeking who he may devour. Whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. But the God of all grace, who hath called us unto his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while or a little while, make you perfect, stabilize and strengthen, settle you. To him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Notice that in verse 10 where it says, after you've suffered a while or a little while. Some have persecutions and torture. We read about that. Thankfully, we haven't seen too much of that in this very age, particularly in this country. But many have sickness and physical pain. Look back over a page or across the page, wherever your Bible is located in 1 Peter 4 and verse 12. Peter says, beloved, think not Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange things happen unto you. So Peter says we are to have fiery trials. He doesn't say what form. We don't know what form our fiery trial will be. Abraham had to be willing to sacrifice his son. That was his fiery trial. Currently, thankfully, there's no widespread persecution and torture of true Christians. Now, we've read about over in the Middle East some of the so-called Christians, the Coptic Christians and all. They've even captured some of them and burned the whole church with them in it. The Muslim Brotherhood there in Egypt did that on more than one occasion. We see all kinds of things. Some of these items make the news, and they highlight one or two, but it's going on all over there. We see a high number of people today in our midst undergoing some very severe health problems. Could this be our fiery trial that Peter spoke of? I just asked that. I reminded of the time David sinned when Satan provoked him to number Israel. If you'll turn back to, I think we'll see a lesson here in 1 Chronicles, the 21st chapter. First Chronicles 21. Doesn't give a lot of detail, but it does say in verse 1, and Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel. That's all that is said there. Now, in other times, God told David to go out and number Israel and count the people. But here, it was apparently a matter of faith that David wanted to, rather than trust God, he was convinced he ought to go out and number Israel. Down in verse 7, and God was displeased with this thing, that he had numbered Israel. Therefore he smote Israel. Now look at verse 12. He gave David a choice. He said, either, this is where Gad, the prophet, came to David and said to him, thus saith the Lord God, choose you. Either 3 years famine, note this pattern of three, 3 years famine or 3 months to be destroyed before your foes, while that the sword of your enemies overtake you, or else 3 days of the sword of the Lord, even the pestilence in the land. So he had a choice to make, and what did David do? Look in verse 13. And David said unto Gad, I'm in a great strait. Let me fall now into the hand of the Lord, for very great are his mercies, and let me not fall into the hand of men. Now we're talking about two different things here. One is David's punishment for sin, and another comparison is our fiery trial. So I think we can see a corollary here. Just as David said, let me fall into the hand of God rather than the hand of men, I would say, and I think you would too, if I had to choose between physical torture, being put in a cage and set afire, or torn apart on a rack, or some kind of real severe persecution, or to have some terrible disease, I think it would be more merciful to die with a disease, you know, and some people have to go through that. Turn over to Matthew, the 24th chapter, in verse 9. 24:9. Jesus, this is a prophecy that Jesus made. Then shall they deliver you to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And many of the apostles and disciples and people of that day were persecuted and killed. So if sickness were to be our fiery trial, I'm not saying just because you're sick that's a fiery trial, but we it is a test sometime for it. We have to trust God. You may think, if I get sick, doesn't God still heal? Well, certainly God very definitely heals, but he does not promise us life in the flesh. It is appointed once to all to die. Solomon wrote, there's a time to be born and a time to die. So we have many in the church today in their 70s, 80s, and even 90s. When I was a young boy, anyone 70 years old was really considered old. It's not considered that old nowadays. In 1900, the life expectancy at birth was 47 for a man and 49 for a woman. In the year 2000, life expectancy at birth for a man was 75 and 80 for a woman. Now, the big difference is in infant mortality and infectious diseases. You know, if you stuck a nail in your foot, you might die of tetanus, or you may get blood poisoning or something, or you may get hurt out working. But for correcting for that, you can look at the mortality, the expected life. You can take somebody in their 40s and 50s back in 1900 compared with 2000, and it's still a big difference. It's not quite as great, but there is a difference. Now, there were people back in the 100 years ago that lived up 100 or more, but they were very, very few. Most, on average, most of them died much younger. I remember when I was about 15 years old, I said, 15 years, I've probably lived a fourth of my life. That's scary, you know, because 60, you know, a lot of people died at 60. And so what have I done? You know, I haven't done anything. I better get with it. So anyway, thankfully God doesn't set a definite time. You know, look at Psalm 90. Psalm 90 and verse 10. I think some of you probably know where I'm going. Psalm 90 and verse 10. The days of our years are 70, and if by reason of strength there be 80 years, yet is there strength, labor, and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. So, and he's speaking of averages here, obviously, and I'm glad it is an average, because that'd be like a death sentence if you got 70, you were going to kick the bucket the day you got 70. So, you know, some die before 70, some after 70, and it says by strength, if you live to be 80, you're going to have labor and sorrow. Now look over what in Ecclesiastes, and we'll see what Solomon said in this regard. Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter. And I'd like to read that out of the Living Translation, or the Living, it's really a paraphrase version, but it's still, sometimes they get it right, and sometimes it's very helpful. I think in this case, it is helpful. Well, you can read along if you want to, if you have the King James or the New King James. But in verse 1, it says, "Don't let the excitement of being young cause you to forget about your Creator. Honor him in your youth before the evil years come, when you will no longer enjoy living. It'll be too late then to try to remember him when the sun and light and moon and stars are dim in your old eyes." In other words, you're losing your vision. "And there's no silver lining left among your clouds. For there will come a time when your limbs will tremble with age, and your strong legs will become weak, and your teeth will be too few to do their work, and there will be blindness too." If you've got the King James, where it talks about your teeth, it calls them grinders. When your grinders would be few, you know. Luckily, most of us today have our teeth, or some good dentures, or maybe a lot of crowns or fillings, but at least we're not missing most of our teeth. Like the people in those days, if they lived to be 80, they would probably have a lot of missing teeth. And continuing on, "Then let your lips be tightly closed while eating, when your teeth are gone." Well, you may be eating pureed food. "And you will waken at dawn with the first note of the birds, but you yourself will be deaf and tuneless with quavering voices. You will be afraid of heights and falling." I know as I get older, I'm not very steady. I'm real careful when I get on a ladder. "And white-haired, withered old man, dragging himself along, without sexual desire, standing at death's door and nearing his everlasting home as the mourners go along the streets. So that's what advice that Solomon gave us to consider God in our youth. And we need to be doing that. Now, you may be in good health, blessed with good physical things to cover all your needs. We as a nation are blessed as almost no other. We live in peace and safety, although the warning signs are on the horizon. Now, things have really changed in the last 15 years ago. I retired in 1999, and the stock market was really doing great. We even had a near-balanced budget. We'd just come out of a few years where they had a surplus. They were talking about how we're going to spend the surplus. Well, where did the surplus go? So now we're, the stock market has gone down. The Cold War was over back then. We thought things were going to be better and better. But I remember somebody said, well, it's a more dangerous world now than it was back during the Cold War. And I thought, well, how foolish is that? You know, Russia's sitting over there with all the nuclear bombs, and we're saying it's more dangerous now, but just look what has happened. We've got still got nuclear bombs in North Korea. Iran is building them, and India and Pakistan have them, and they're all fighting and quarreling, and we don't know where our next trouble is coming from. Of course, we had the Twin Towers, and we've had two major wars since then, and our present circumstances just doesn't look very good. We say unemployment is up, but when you really look at the numbers, it's because, I mean, unemployment is reduced and the unemployment is down. But when you look at the numbers, it's because a lot of people have quit looking. And a lot of the new jobs are part-time jobs. So middle-class income is going down. Now look at world conditions. The Jordanian pilot this week, I think Dr. Erwiller said in his announcements, when you think it's not going to get any worse, just look. So I'm afraid what might happen next week. You know, it's been so bad, it seemed like every week it's getting worse. It didn't make much news, but one day in the Longview paper, Boko Haram had killed 90 civilians in Cameroon. And, you know, and I read another article, I think it was in today's paper, it said over 10,000 had died this year in Cameroon, Niger, Chad, and Nigeria, and 100,000 displaced due to this group, this Muslim group over there that goes, Boko Haram, I'm not sure what that, they've all got a different name. They probably mean something in Arabic. Now, we have churches there in Nigeria. Now, Nigeria is a large country, and I think most of the problem they're having is in the north, and more down towards the coast, the populated areas where our people are. But it could be soon that even some of our church people will come into that. And I'm sure they would be targets pretty soon. And we read about the American aide, Carla Mueller, that was reportedly killed this week. You know, they don't know all the circumstances, but things are just getting out of hand. Europe, Ukraine, Russia, and China are all having all kind of financial problems, particularly now that the price of oil has gone down. That's affecting Russia and Venezuela and Iran. Greece is in serious trouble again. The price of oil going down has really caused problems for some of our enemies, but it's also beginning to affect us. Overall, it's a help if it stays at about $50 or $60 a barrel, but they say if it goes to $30 a barrel, the whole world could go into recession. I've got a neighbor that's been working out on a drilling rig, making probably, well, way over $100,000 a year out at Abilene. He works, he's on 14 days and off 14 days. He just got laid off. Both the drilling rigs are based in Longview. They're shut down. I read where Halliburton is laying off 15,000, and these are all high-paying jobs. So, you know, some of them are going to be going to take a lot lower paying jobs or drawing unemployment. So the whole world is getting very unstable. The currency is just a confidence game. We think, well, I've got dollars in my pocket. Everything's okay. But the whole world economy is based a lot on the U.S. dollar because the U.S. dollar is a reserve currency. If that changes where the U.S. dollar is not the reserve currency, you know, your money may not be worth anything in a few weeks. You may think if you have $100,000 or more in cash, you'd be in pretty good shape if you used it wisely. But, you know, if the reserve currency was not the U.S. dollar, it may not be worth much for very long. What that means is if Brazil buys something from Europe, they have to pay for it in dollars. So they have to change their money into dollars and then go take those dollars. And if you've ever traveled abroad and you've got to go change your money from U.S. dollars to euros or some other currency, you're going to pay an exchange fee. And sometimes you're shocked. You may lose 10 or 15%. Right now the dollar's up, but it can go either way. Now, if we're not the reserve currency and it gets to be the Chinese, whatever they call it, the euro or something else, we would have to change our money. If they wouldn't take, if we couldn't buy oil with dollars, we'd have to change it into rubles or something to buy oil, and we're going to lose there too. So we could, the greenback is just paper, so we'd be in pretty bad shape. We're not on the gold standard anymore. If all the financial systems in the world start failing, you know, the physical goods will be here, but they won't be refined. They won't be, you know, somebody else might own them. Pensions would probably not function, pension plans, banks would close, electricity may be available only part of the time. You know, the sad part of the thing, not like the people 150 years ago in the movies I was telling you about, they grew and preserved their own food. We don't even know how to can. Most of the young people today are dry things, or they could freeze things, but if there's no electricity, they wouldn't even have that. They don't have a garden. People just don't know how to live except out of the supermarket and but this modern world. Now, there's rogue nations like North Korea and ISIS and to some extent Iran. They're totally unpredictable. You know, if I were a diplomat for whatever country, I wouldn't want to go into and negotiate with ISIS. You may not come out. Just because you're an ambassador, almost as bad in North Korea, I think at least in Iran, still they would negotiate, you know, back during the years, you know, even with the battles and medieval times, you know, they'd hold up a white flag and they'd come out and meet between the battle lines and talk. Well, these people, they wouldn't honor anything like that. You know, there's all kinds of things we could have, all sorts of problems. You know, we see prophecies of the wild animals and all. I used to think, well, that's kind of strange. We don't have any wild animals that much. But you'd be surprised what's out there at night. I had coyotes. It killed a calf about a month ago, so I started looking around for a trapper, and there's some local people over there to trap. And this last 2 weeks, they've caught 7 coyotes on my place, and I still see them running around. And I think they caught a beaver, 7 coyotes, a possum, a rabbit, and a turtle. And I wasn't too worried about the turtle, but the guy comes by every day and he's got a four-wheeler with a little, well, it's what's called a mule, a Kawasaki mule. He backs it off his trailer and he runs the traps. He's had 5 bobcats, and those were caught within just a mile or two of my place. He said the bobcats are everywhere. Now, I've never seen a bobcat, but there's bobcats. He said he's caught 5 gray foxes in the last year right by his house. And he said there's red foxes. I may have it backwards. There's red foxes and gray foxes. One is more wild than the other. So he's caught all these things are around. I've got a neighbor that he's seen a mountain lion. And I thought maybe he was stretching the fact, but I've talked to some people. They say there are a few mountain lions that come through this area. I talked to a guy down at the sale barn. He said he's a buyer. He goes from sale. And he said he saw a cow that it had a scratch marks all on its back where this mountain lion had jumped down a tree and actually didn't kill the cow, but it pretty well scratched and tore it up. So there's things out there, and, you know, things could get bad enough, we would start seeing problems. If we start having rioting, civil unrest, disease, food shortages, we could have situations so bad we might want to see the international peacekeepers come in. You know, I don't know how that's going to be. Hopefully we'll never come to that, but all the details are not given. But look over in 1 Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 3. For then they will say, peace and safety. Then sudden destruction comes upon them that travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. So we see near the end time, there's going to be some pretty bad situations. You know, there's going to be a lack of peace and safety, and then maybe it's when the false prophet comes in or somebody puts a little temporary order in place. But so when they shall say peace and safety, that's when you better watch out. But it says in verse 4, but ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day shall overtake you as a thief. For ye are the children of light and the children of the day. We're not in the night or of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. For they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunken are drunk in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet the hope of salvation. For God has not appointed to us wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ. So we have to put our trust and confidence in Him. Those are rather encouraging words. It's a promise He's made to us. Now, in starting out, I said I would focus more on ourselves. Now, we talked a good bit about the world condition, but there's no point in talking about ourselves if the world was a perfect place. So what can we do? What can you do? What can we do personally? It's kind of like a train coming down a crooked mountain road and a sharp curve ahead with a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit, but his throttle is stuck and he can't stop it. You know, I guess you could jump off, but otherwise the train's going to jump the track, or the train's going into the brick wall, immovable object, unstoppable object running into an immovable object. You've always heard that story. We can't do much overall for world conditions. Things are getting worse and more out of control at all levels. This Kayla Jean Mueller, the 26, the girl from Phoenix, she was an aid worker that went over to Syria, so she thought she could do some good. She's been in prison for 18 months and now apparently killed. If she did any good, it was very short-lived. She thought she could help and relieve suffering in the world, but apparently ISIS didn't agree. So we can't do it at the world level. So we as individuals can't do much at the world, can't do much at the national or local level, or even on the local scene. We can only work with our own lives, our own selves. God is testing us. He tested Abraham in chapter 22. He tested all the major figures of the Bible. Thankfully, we probably won't be tested like Abraham, Peter, or Paul might have been tested, but we will be tested one way or the other. Turn back to Genesis, the 22nd chapter. Genesis 22. Just want to read one verse there. And it's verse 12. Now, this is after Abraham had been asked to sacrifice Isaac, and he took him up on the mountain and he bound him and he had his knife raised over his head, ready to thrust it into him. And he heard the voice. In verse 11, an angel of the Lord called upon him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here am I. And he said, lay not your hands upon the lad, neither do thou any harm unto him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." So he had to go through a very difficult test. He was as good as dead in Abraham's sight because he was going to obey God. And God made a covenant with Abraham. It was now unconditional. And God is the keeper of the covenant. Look at Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, verse 9. Deuteronomy 7 and verse 9. "Know therefore that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him and keeps his commandments for 1,000 to 1,000 generations." And in Daniel the 9th chapter in verse 4, following up on this theme, Daniel 9 and verse 4, where Daniel said, "I prayed to the Lord my God and made my confession and said, O Lord, the dreadful God," and see how he addressed him, "keeping the covenant and mercy to them that love him and to them." You can make a whole study about how God is the keeper of the covenant. I've got an idea one of these days I may have a sermon or a sermonette on that. He will keep his covenants, all of them. He will keep his covenants with us as well. Hebrews 13, chapter 13 and verse 5, it concludes by saying, "I will never leave you or forsake you." And of course, that is a quote out of Genesis 28 and verse 15. So God has promised he will never leave us and forsake us. We need to assess ourselves. We're coming up not too many weeks from Passover, so we need to assess ourselves. Turn to Matthew 13. Got a lot of parables in Matthew 13, and several of them are appropriate to what we're talking about here today. Matthew 13, picking it up with verse 3. "And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives over against the temple, Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, 'Tell us when these things shall be, and what shall be the sign when all these things will fulfill?'" I'm in Mark. No wonder that didn't sound right. Matthew 13. Matthew 13. What did I read about? As you get old, your eyes get weaker and you can't see. Maybe that's the problem I'm having. Matthew 13, verse 3. "And he spake many things of them in parables, saying, Behold, a sower went forth to sow. And when he sowed, some seeds fell on the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. In verse 5, some fell upon stony places where they had not much earth, and forthwith they sprang up because they had no deepness of earth. They were in just shallow soil and they came right up. And when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell upon thorns, and the thorns sprung up and choked them. And others fell upon good ground and brought forth fruit, some 100-fold and some 60-fold and some 30-fold. Who has ears to hear, let him hear." And, of course, he gives the answer what this meant later in the chapter. He told them in verse 16, "Blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For I verily say to you that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see the things which you see and have not seen them, and heard those things which you hear and have not heard them. Hear you therefore the parable of the sower." In other words, he say, understand the parable of the sower. And this is verse 19. This is talking about the ones that fell by the wayside. That was back in verse 4 where they fell by the wayside. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and understands it not, then comes the wicked one and catches away that which was sown in his heart. This is he which receives seeds by the wayside. They hear, but they don't really understand. the seed has been sown. Christ sowed the seed. He's given them an opportunity, but they didn't understand. Perhaps they won't be held responsible. And those are the hearers. You know, we come to the what would be called the quitters, verse 20. But he that receives seeds in stony places, the same is he that heareth the word, and anon with joy received it. Yet he has not rooted himself, but endures for a while. But when tribulation or persecution arise because of the word, by and by he is offended. So when he falls away, he doesn't last. That reminds me, years ago back in Longview, we had a couple that they'd heard the broadcast or the telecast, I don't remember which, read the literature. They came to church. They were both baptized in the first month. They were the most enthusiastic couple I'd ever seen. They were there at every service, every activity. They wanted to serve and do all they could. In about 3 or 4 months' time, they quit altogether. Nobody knew really what happened. And they fit this pattern. I think, I don't even remember their name, but I remember them well, how they looked, and we were so happy to see them, but they didn't stay there. And I should have read verse 21. This happened because they had no root, and what I did, and he's offended. In verse 22, we come then, you could call these the backsliders, or those that fell among thorns. He also that receives seed among the thorns is he that heareth the word, and the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. So that's the third class of people that God has been called or made the word available to. And in verse 23, he that receiveth seed is on the good ground is he that heareth the word and understands it, which also bears fruit and brings forth some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. So here we have four classes of people. And all these people, note, are people that have been exposed to the word. The master has sowed the seed, and they received it in different ways. This parable does not represent all the people of the world. But there's three other parables in this same chapter that talk about the kingdom. Verse 24 is one, 31 is another, and 33 starts another short one. But we want to concentrate on this one in 13:24. Another parable put he forth among them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened to a man that sowed good seed in the field. We just heard about the seed that was sown by Christ to begin with. And while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. And when the blade was sprung up, when the seed sprouted and brought forth fruit, there appeared the tares also. But it's not, they wasn't visible when they first came up, but it was when the fruit was set, when the seed pod was set. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? From whence then has it tares? Where did the tares come from? And he said to them, an enemy has done this. The servant said unto him, will you then that we go and root them up? He said, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. In the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares and bind them in bundles and burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. Now, he gave two more parables about the kingdom, and they didn't ask any questions about it. Apparently, they understood what he was saying. But look down in verse 26. Then Jesus sent the multitudes away and went to the house, and the disciples came to him, saying, declare unto us the parable of the tares of the field. They didn't quite understand what he was saying. And he answered and said to them, he that sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the word, good seed of the children of the kingdom, but the tares are the children of the wicked one. That enemy has sowed them. The enemy that sowed them is the devil. In other words, tares were sown of the devil. They were never converted in the first place. They just appeared to be. Only the when it come up, they all looked the same when they sowed them in the field. The harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall be the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of the kingdom all the things that offend and them that do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire. Then shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And then shall the righteous shine as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who has ears to hear, let him hear. So we see a case here. This is a fifth group of people. We've already covered four people that were exposed to the kingdom that God, you might say, is calling. The seed went out and it fell on various kinds of ground and they responded different ways. But here we see a case where the devil sowed the seed. It wasn't God doing the calling. It was the devil. Therefore, the tares were never converted. They didn't fall away. You don't fall away and become a tare. And I've heard over the years people say, don't get lukewarm and fall away and become a tare. Well, that's not the way it works. The tares were never called of God. They were sowed by the devil. Some may not even know they were tares. They may think they're converted. I hope we need to examine ourselves. Now, if you look at the commentaries and read this, it says the tares and wheat couldn't be determined or distinguished at first. It was only when they brought forth fruit on the top of the grain head, the grain on top of the, was it obvious. The tares were worthless. They called it darnel. It had a dark or black seed on it, whereas the wheat was a golden brown, edible. And Jesus said both would exist at the end of the age. So we know that we will have tares with us, as well as these other four classes that we just read about. But what about the wolves of sheep's clothing? Are they the same as tares? Where do they fit? They're not the tares. Turn back to Matthew, the 7th chapter, in verse 15. Matthew 7 and verse 15. It says, beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. You shall know them by their fruits. No man gathers grapes or thorns or figs of thistles. So it was a little easier to distinguish the wolves from the tares. Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but the corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Therefore, by their fruits you shall know them. So it's a little easier to tell a false prophet from a tare, but they're neither one are converted. And look at Matthew 10 and verse 16. Matthew 10 and 16. Behold, I send you as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. We heard about this in the sermonette. But they're in our midst. So he sends them into the world, and he said there's going to be wolves in the world. According to Jesus' own prophecy, we'll have both tares and wolves, which are right with us up to the end. Now, we've talked about six different groups. The four people represented by the sower, where they received the word and responded in different ways. Then we had the tares, which are sown by the devil. Then we had the false prophets. And does that include all the people in the world? Well, no, it doesn't. There's other people in the world that's not in either one of these groups. In fact, the most people of the world are not in these groups, in these six groups. That's all the people who have never been exposed to the truth, which will come up in the second resurrection, which will then have their opportunity for salvation. So and you probably could break those down. I don't know that Adolf Hitler and Saddam Hussein and some of those people, if they might not even be in a different category from some of the people who were just good people but just hadn't been called. Like the people I talked about in the movie. You know, there was pioneers that went out. They were good, hardworking, honest people that God was allowing a nation to be established, but they didn't really know the truth. They believed in God, but they didn't really understand because God hadn't revealed himself to them like he has it to most people down through the ages. He's got a plan. He's working it out in a very systematic way according to his purpose. And we're blessed to be called and given his truth at this time. Back to the question, what can we do? Or what you can say, what can I do? Well, the short answer is nothing or very little on the world scene or even on the local scene. It wouldn't do any good to go out here and start a petition to correct things. You know, it'd just cause more confusion. You could say, well, it's the same at the church scene. Look at 1 Corinthians, the 12th chapter. It's talking about spiritual gifts. 1 Corinthians 12. Verse 1, now therefore concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I would not have you ignorant. And look down at verse 4. But there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There's different gifts. Some people have one talent, some another. They all got to work together. And in verse 11, but all these worketh that one and the same. But all these worketh that one and the same Spirit, dividing every man severally as he wills. They've got different talents, different responsibilities. In verse 21. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor the head to the feet, I have no need of you. The eye can't change the hand. The arm can't change the leg. They have to work together in unison. So we can't go out and individually change the church. We need to work together as a team, part of a team, working together. In verse 22, nay, much more than those members of the body which seem to be more feeble are necessary. We're all necessary working together. And these members of the body which we think be less honorable, upon these we bestow more abundant honor, and our uncomely parts have more abundant comeliness. For our comely parts have no need, but God has tempered the body together, having given more abundant honor to all the parts which lacketh. That there should be no schism in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. So we see we've got to work within the body. We can't change the body. We can't go out on a campaign to try to do something, and no more than we can change our local community or our national government or the world scene. We can assist the church, but that alone is not enough. The church can't save us. We can't ride on others' coattails. And that's shown very plainly in Ezekiel, the 14th chapter, where it says, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says the Lord God. So it comes down to an individual basis. We've got to work within the body, support the body, but we have to do our part. Now, there's been many splits and divisions in the Church of God groups over the years, Christians in all, I suppose. We can know them by their fruits, but God is the ultimate judge, and I'm glad for that. It's his responsibility. We are individually responsible for our own salvation with God's help and guidance, of course. That's the important thing. There's another thing we can do. And I want to turn back to Ezekiel. Well, we're in Ezekiel already, but turn back to chapter 9 in verse 4. Ezekiel 9 in verse 4. And the Lord said unto him, Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of men that sigh and cry for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. He had an ink horn, a writing horn, or a pen, you might say, by his side. He said, Go put a mark on all those that sigh and cry. In verse 6, But slay utterly the old and young, both maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary, then to begin at the ancient men which were before the house. So God takes note of those that are marked, those that are identified. So he said, put a mark on them where they'll be identified. That's not out of character what he did at the first Passover. You remember back in Exodus 12 and verse 13, where they were to kill the lamb and put the blood on the doorpost. So when the angel flew over, most likely it was Jesus Christ that did that, but it'd been supposedly called the death angel, but it doesn't say death angel. So they were protected by the mark that was on the doorpost. And in Revelation, the 7th chapter, if you turn over there, we'll see another mark. Revelation 7 and verse 3. Therefore saying, Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of the God in their forehead. In other words, they put some kind of mark on their forehead, where they'd be protected from the trumpets and the plagues that were to follow. Back in verses 1 through 3, it talks about the angels having the standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds back. These were the angels that were to blow the trumpets to cause these plagues to come upon the earth. So it wasn't out of character that God marked those that were to be set aside, and in Ezekiel it says, mark those that sigh and cry. Now I want to look quickly at two examples of people who had the opportunity to sigh and cry. First, look back at Daniel, the 10th chapter. Verse 1. And 2, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a thing was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. And the thing was true, but the time appointed was long. And he understood the thing and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. And skipping down to verse 14, this is where the angel, and this is probably Gabriel in context here, he came to Daniel, and now I'm come to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days, for the vision is for many days. It's not going to happen right now. It's in the latter days. And when he had spoken such words to me, I set my face towards the ground, and I became dumb. He couldn't even speak. And behold, one like the similitudes of the sons of men touched my lips. And I opened my mouth and spake and said unto him that stood before me, O my Lord, by the vision my sorrows are turned upon me, and I have retained no strength. How can the servant of this my Lord talk with this my Lord? And as for me, straightway there remained no strength in me, neither was there any breath left in me. Then there came again and touched me one like the appearance of a man, and he strengthened me. So here we see Daniel, just the life fell out of him. He couldn't even stand. He couldn't even speak. He was weak. I would say Daniel sighed and cried for all the things he saw that was coming in the latter days. It was many days off, but yet it really disturbed him because he loved Jerusalem. He loved Israel and Judah. He wanted them to be able to return, and he realized that was not going to happen. So he sighed and cried. Turn with me now for the second example back to 2 Kings 20. We'll pick it up in verse 14. Then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah and said to him, what are these men? These are the men that had just come down from Babylon to visit him. And whence came they unto thee? And Hezekiah said, they come from a far country, even from Babylon. And he said, what have they seen in your house? And Hezekiah answered, all the things that are in mine house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasure that I have not showed them. And look at verse 16. And Isaiah said unto Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days come that all is in your house, and they and that which your fathers have laid in store unto this day shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And your sons that shall issue from you, which you have begat, they shall take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So did Hezekiah sigh and cry? Here's what Hezekiah said. Then said Hezekiah unto Israel, good is the word of the Lord which you have spoken. And he said, is this not good if peace and truth be in my days? He said earlier in the chapter it wouldn't happen in his days. So as long as it didn't happen to him, it wasn't any big concern. But on the other hand, Daniel, when he saw what was coming upon Israel in the latter days, it made him sigh and cry. So compare the reaction to Daniel and Hezekiah. I would say that Daniel sighed and cried. It doesn't appear to me that Hezekiah, he was rather glib. Just he was happy it wasn't going to come upon him. So who you think God was the most pleased with? So where are we headed, and what can we do about it? We can't have much effect on the overall outcome of the world, nation, or for that matter, even the church. We just have to be part of the church, and we have to have our relation with God and support one another. We're only able to affect our personal outcome and destiny. It said, work out your own salvation with trembling, fear and trembling. And that takes a great deal of help from God and His Spirit. We can't do it alone. He's promised to never leave or forsake us. That is a covenant that He's made with us at baptism. And it's just as sure as the one He made with Abraham when he was called on to sacrifice Isaac. Because He, like Daniel described God, the keeper of the covenants. He's the keeper of all the covenants He made. God cannot lie. So we know when God says a thing, it's true. What can we do? We can only pray your kingdom come. We can be a good example and let our light shine. We haven't read those scriptures, but that's certainly one thing we could do. And then lastly, we should sigh and cry for all the abominations we see in the world around us. So where are we headed? Where are you headed? Hopefully we can say, oh, who will come and go with me to the promised land?